Hi, everyone, and welcome to Engineering Innovations, the official podcast of Purdue University's Elmore Family School of Electrical and Computer Engineering. I'm your host, Kristen Malabenda, and today we're talking about something that sounds like science fiction, but it's very real. Materials that are just one atom thick. They're called two-dimensional, or 2D materials, and they have the potential to change the way our computers, phones, and just about every electronic device works. To help us understand what makes these materials so special, I'm joined by Dr. Jörg Abtzeller. He's the Barry M. and Patricia L. Epstein Professor here at Purdue ECE. His research focuses on finding out how these paper-thin materials behave, how they could be used in electronics of the future, and why researchers are so excited about them. Jörg, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about your journey to get here to Purdue and what led you to this type of research with 2D materials.
Yeah, I would say I could not have predicted that I end up here at Purdue at all when I was younger. I started out in Germany studying physics. And then when I was almost through my studies, I realized that being book smart for me was not interesting enough. I wanted to have some hands-on experience, but there was really not too much I could do. And I told my mom at that point in time that I would quit and become a medical doctor.
Hey.
And that was very close to the end of my studies. So you can imagine that she was not very happy about that. It was lucky, very lucky, to bump into a friend of mine on the street. And he said, you know what? I felt exactly the same way like you. And what I did is I had an opportunity to work hands-on experimental work at the research center in Jülich. So I went there and I loved it. And gained my passion back because I realized that really all the stuff I had learned in class now finally came to some application.
Yeah.
And that was just fantastic. So I knew I found my passion. I got my PhD in Germany as well. And then I wanted to become a faculty. So the path there is a little bit different. It's not about tenure. So I started out with the equivalent of an assistant professor in physics. And a couple of years, I had an opportunity to come to MIT as a visiting scientist. That was in 1998. And I still thought I would go back, pursue my faculty career in Germany. But then towards the end of the second year, because this was a collaboration between IBM T.J. Watson and MIT, I got a phone call from a manager at IBM. He said, what about you staying with us? We would like to hire you. I called my wife. I had a little boy at this point in time with us in Boston. And I said, what about change of plans? And she said, yes.
Great.
So that was really surprising and just a wonderful thing for all of us. We are looking back to this often and thinking, yeah, this was one of those moments in life where everything is changing. And I was lucky, and I should add that for a long, long time in my physics career, my physics colleagues would look at me and saying, well, what you're doing, solid state physics, that's dirt physics. So that's really not high end. As we are doing string theory and particle physics was considered to be high end physics. And by electrical engineering colleagues, they would look at me and saying, if you're studying physics, you really have no idea about what electrical engineering is all about. So I was really stuck in the middle as the odd duck, I guess. But I liked it. And exactly when IBM made me that offer to join them in 2001, that was a time where many companies and universities were looking for people like me. Suddenly, they realized the nanoelectronics world had developed in such a way that your conventional wisdom of engineering, electrical engineering, was not quite enough. And so I was one of the very few that suddenly had plenty of opportunities. Exactly, not predictable at all. So I had a great time for 7 years at IBM T.J. Watson. And then I decided that I wanted to go back to academia. I had a couple of opportunities to introduce myself through presentations at various universities and a couple of offers. And Mark Landstrom is to be credited to bring me here.
Okay.
18 years ago. But he told me that the weather here is the same as New York. So that was not quite true.
No.
New York, I had to shovel some snow, but the first couple of years here, it was unbelievable. Snow yet above my head and very cold, and then the humidity in the summer. So in any case, I've never regretted to come here. I raised both of my boys here, and I had a great time all through my career. The best part about Purdue, and I'm taking quite a bit of time, is really how collegial of all the people. This made the biggest difference for me. Not only the people on the street, extremely friendly, you know, maybe New York person not known for being like that.
Right.
But people here are amazing, and the colleagues have made it such a pleasure to interact. I like to work in teams, and I've had plenty of opportunity.
That's great. So what exactly are 2D materials? how are they different from what we're using, and how did you get involved in this research?
Yeah, so let me first talk about how I got involved. I was always looking for novel types of materials and devices, for electronic devices. Using the term device, I'm talking about transistors mostly. And so this is what I was working on my entire career. When I came to IBM, we were actually the first group that had presented and demonstrated experimentally a carbon nanotube transistor that was back in the days, 1999, something around then. And I kept working on these special materials to see whether I could push the envelope towards application. Now, carbon nanotubes are already one of those unique kind of materials. They're actually one dimension, not even two dimension. Then I worked on, and I come to the question that you asked, what means two dimension in a second. And then I worked on nanowires, and I worked on graphene. That was the first two-dimensional material that was out there until I switched over in about 2011. That was when it was already here, to so-called transition metal dichar collagenides. These are 2D materials. Now to your question. So in our normal world, like silicon, three-dimensional structures have really three-dimensional bonds. So bonds between silicon sticking out in every direction, right? There's no limitation in the plane. And so what you get in this way is a crystal, anything that is solid and looks 3D type. Now in vision, nature has actually built materials that don't have that 3D bond structure, but instead they're only looking for partners in the two-dimensional planes. Okay. And they're holding hands between atoms really in this two-dimensional plane only that was first discovered in graphene. And what that means is there is no third dimension where they are trying to look for other atoms in order to build a crystal. And that makes them extremely inert in this direction. Think about graphite as a lubricant. Why is it a good lubricant? Because these 2D sheets can slide relative to each other. There is no bonding between them. And so now if you go back to just one of those two-dimensional materials, that is what I'm dealing with. Just one sheet of these atoms in case of transition metal dichar collagenides. Actually, there are two different types of atoms involved, but that doesn't change the story. There's still nothing that bonds upwards and downwards. And so that makes them really unique and different.
So you mentioned graphene, which was the first big breakthrough in this field. What did the discovery of graphene teach us, and why was it so important?
Yeah, so early on, people noticed that in graphene, the electrons can move long distance at room temperature before they get scattered, meaning before they contribute to the resistance of the material.
Okay.
So that was fascinating for many researchers, because in the world of silicon transistors, we are always looking for something that we call ballistic transport can be enabled, where an electron can travel a long distance, because that means I get better performance in terms of current drive out of my transistor. What was unnoticed, and I went actually to a conference on where there was a misconception, people said, well, graphene is not a semiconductor. So it becomes a semiconductor.
Yeah.
Graphene is not a semiconductor, but it's close enough. We believe we can make really great transistors out of that. It turns out you can't.
Okay.
And the reason is that you need what's called in the electronic world a band gap. You need to have a forbidden energetic zone in your structure. You need to have something that doesn't conduct at all times. The difference could be trying to be too tutorial, but a metal, if you're lowering the temperature, you will still have conductivity.
Okay.
If you do the same with a semiconductor or an insulator, you will not.
Okay.
But that is actually the key for having a transistor, which is a switch. You need to be able to turn the switch on and off, and you have to have this banded gap in place. Graphene doesn't have that, but the discovery of these transition metal dichar collagenides was exciting because it combined the feature of being two-dimensional and having band gaps, so now we could really build transistors that can outperform what silicon can do.
Memory is another area that you study. What role could these 2D materials play in making memory faster or more efficient?
May I answer a question that
Absolutely.
You didn't ask first? Forgive me.
Yes.
I want to just say, why should we care about introducing these materials into the transistor world? Actually, you will find that many of companies that are building, that are foundries, and that are looking into building transistors for us, really for your computer, for my iPhone, whatever. They have all two-dimensional materials now on their bucket list of things that will happen. They, in the roadmaps, that's how we're calling it, right? You see that in around 2036, pretty much all these companies, Samsung, Intel, iMac, they're saying, or TSMC, they're all saying the same. That is when we probably have to transition over to smart materials. And the question is why? Why would you do that? Because historically, every time we brought up a new material or concept, industry would say, whoa, no, you're not going to do that, because it costs us a lot to establish new process modules. Yeah. So why are they willing to consider it? Because there is no alternative. You need to go to these very thin materials in order to continue the trend of improving the device characteristics. And that has to do with the way that transistors operate. The transistor operates by having three terminals, and one of them is what's called the gate. And the gate needs to be able to control the electrostatics in that system. And that requires you to go to these ultra-thin bodies. So I want to just wrap up that. Memory application is something else. So think about a word, people have described that like Lego blocks, where you are building a system and stacking together all sorts of different two-dimensional materials, right? Like Lego. Mm-hmm. We're building something in this way. Very highly integrated. It's called monolithic integration or heterogeneous integration. So in this case, what we need in the world of devices and chips is three things. We need logic. That's the transistor I just described. We need memory to store information. And we need something that's called interconnects, which connects all these different elements. So it would be nice if you could have all of this done with two-dimensional materials, or at least to a large extent. So logic, I explained. So looking for memories for a long, long time. And then a student of mine discovered, and it's really a discovery that was not predicted at all, discovered that she could create a memory element from this novel two-dimensional materials that shows properties that have been not previously observed. You could create with an electric field what's called a phase transition, slight distortion in these 2D atoms that created a different resistance through the structure. And that's actually the key for novel memory application, that if you can dial in different resistance values at will, then you have something that can store zeros and ones and even more different kind of bit levels. And that is exactly what she discovered in these 2D materials. And we are looking integration with transistors, logic, building blocks as well.
So interconnects, those are often a bottleneck. How do 2D materials help combat that?
Yeah. So the space that we are having available for these connections between logic, building blocks, and memories becomes increasingly small. So it's not just that the elements become small, but also the connections themselves have very little space. And so what is used currently is called copper. And copper is a wonderful material when it comes to conductivity, but it diffuses, and that can cause trouble in your chips. And so what the industry is doing there is they are putting some liners in place. You need to picture this as a groove. You have a groove and you want to fill this with copper, but you can't do it right away. So you put some liners and diffusion barriers in place before you fill that.
Okay.
But those take up space. And so what is left over for copper becomes now even smaller, which is bad.
Yeah.
Because it's not just increasing the resistance, it's increasing the resistivity. So it's changing the material properties per se. It's not just the dimensions that now come into the game for the resistance, but the material really becomes higher resistive, which is a very bad thing. And so two-dimensional materials, what they can do is these liners and diffusion barriers, which using up a certain space, right? We have shown that if you're using 2D materials for both liner and diffusion barriers, they're using up the least amount of space that leaves you more copper for your interconnect. So that's why you want to use 2D materials in this context.
Also, your group studies electron transport contacts and interfaces in these 2D materials. Give us a sense of what that means and why that matters.
So thinking about transistors, in a transistor, you have something that injects electrons, that's called the source, and something that takes these electrons in, that's a drain. And you have a third terminal, which is called the gate. The gate is literally like the flood gate or a gate that you have when you want to regulate water flow. And so the water flow is now the electron flow from the source to the drain, and the gate manipulates that flow. And so now when I'm looking at this transistor, these three terminals, I have contacts that are source and drain, and they need to be very, very good contacts. So that's where we are studying, how can we make these contacts as low resistive as possible, because we want to have an easy way to inject carriers. The gate stack is the other dimension. So there, what we want to do is we want to combine these two-dimensional material with something that has very tight gate control. You don't want to leak electrons in from the gate, but you want to just tightly control that. That is where the body of these two-dimensional material is really greatly beneficial. But the problem comes, there's always the
yes.
Always the win. So I told you about the inertness of these 2D materials. Because they're inert, to build this gate stack is very, because nothing wants to stick on it. Everything slides off.
Okay.
And so we're finding ways of tricking this material into still sticking to something that doesn't want to be stuck.
Gotcha.
It's very, very challenging. And we are definitely at the forefront of doing this. The team here at Purdue that I'm working with on 2D,
a limited team. And we are also working together with IMEC on this. We made it our focus that we want to really drive the application forward. For a long, long time, I've been looking at basic fundamental research, and now I'm at the stage in my career where I want to push this forward to the application, motivated by the fact that my younger son, who's 25, said to me once, "Dad, what did you accomplish in your..."
Oh, seeing the kids always get you.
Could have something to point to that because they... This
exactly. So I don't think people can really visualize the size of a 2D material. So explain how you work with something, what tools and techniques you use to work with something that's only a single layer of atoms thick.
So these 2D materials are grown on what is called a substrate, often a sapphire substrate, in order to have the type of nice 2D behavior, and the atoms need to be exactly at the right positions that I described, because we have two different types. Once we have them grown, and growth in itself is a problem. We are not working here at Purdue a lot on the growth. Instead, we are collaborating with other teams on this, or we are also purchasing these 2D materials. Then you need to kind of transfer them onto the substrate that you're dealing with. So in essence, to make a long story short, we always have what we call handling wafers. Wafers that are really just there, carry this 2D to the next kind of stage of processing. In themselves, often these carrying wafers are not really useful for the device, but they allow us to do the fabrication steps. Once I have a handling wafer, you can picture this as a thin but nice to carry material where you can use a tweezer and you can manipulate, because now your 2D materials is on there and then you're carrying it around and build things up, because you can't touch the 2D material, and then it would definitely falter. It would not want to work with you yet.
So do you see these 2D materials as complementing silicon or eventually replacing it?
So for the very first time, I think there is a chance that they might replace silicon. There's something in this silicon stack that is called front end of line and back end of line. So let me quickly describe that. Front end of line means that we have really the smallest possible silicon and germanium transistors there. And then we are stacking actually devices and interconnect together until we get into higher metal layers. And so there is a discussion and there's an understanding that introducing something at this higher level of the stack is actually easier than doing this at the front end.
Okay.
So leave it up to silicon to build things up to this point. The foundries would be doing that. But then add maybe something special that's often called CMOS plus X. So that X could be a 2D memory, could be a 2D transistor, etc. So that is the lower hanging fruit. Not a given, don't get me wrong.
Right.
But it's a lower hanging fruit. We are looking into front end of line, really replacing silicon even there with these 2D materials. And that requires even more careful process modeling. But it's not out of the question and is actually on our to-do list.
So how far away are we from seeing these 2D materials in real world devices?
So I think I mentioned before that on the roadmaps that I've seen, the industry sees it as being manufactured in 2036.
Okay.
So that's not that far away anymore, considering that for manufacturing, you need to look into other issues like yield and reproducibility and reliability. So I think this is doable. If we have a couple of years to iron out the fundamental kind of problems with the process modules, the contact and the gate stacks, then at some point, the industry will take that on. I know that already now there are pathfinders in the industry that are also working in parallel on this.
Yeah.
So you need to look at the research landscape as follows. The industry is interested in what we are doing. They're not going to wait just for us to do that. They have their own work going on, but they enhance that by paying for research that is done at universities.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, but that's a one-way street, okay? They don't tell us what they are working on, but they carefully, once they're happy, they just absorb it and work on
right
by themselves. The mere fact that we have very nice funding for this 2D effort shows that the industry is serious about this.
Right.
they really consider, will it happen? For sure, no, that's not the point. But they have it on their list of the one, two things that really need to be pushed forward in order for them to be successful in the future.
You mentioned your student who made an important discovery that helped your research. How do students in general get involved in this work with you, and what role do they play in moving that research forward?
Yeah, so I have a group of PhD students, and of course here in the United States, all comes down to funding. And hopefully you can kind of work on something that's interesting for yourself, but also interesting for others, because then you can receive funding. And whenever I see an opportunity to propose something to a company, to a consortium, to the government for funding, I'm trying to convince them that there is a need to do research on this. If I succeed, then I can look out for a capable student. I'm always interviewing students ahead of time. I have my little database of those that I would love to hire, but I cannot until I get the funding. And then the students get onboarded. The thing that makes it a little bit more difficult for my group than for others is all of my students have to work in the Burke Nanotechnology Center. Okay. And they have to be hands-on. They have to really fabricate things. There are hundreds and hundreds of tools in the Burke Nanotechnology Center, and they need to be able to use many of them.
Wow.
It takes about a year plus for them to be trained.
Okay.
So you can imagine there's a sponsor that gives me dollars, and they want to see outcomes. I can't tell them, hey, wait a year that the student is trained, and then we see whether I can produce something.
Yeah.
So I need to kind of always find ways of doing this training while I'm coupling the new student with some experienced student, so that I can training and kind of get the experienced student to deliver results at the same time. Because otherwise the sponsors will not be happy, and I would not be successful in doing it. I've done that since 18 years nonstop. It has worked out very well. But I do ask another question, namely, what is a student concretely doing? Well, they are doing, in the first place, they are trying to use the concept that I'm describing to them, and they're trying to make it work. I've been working myself, so I know what I'm talking about there. And at the same time, after they get trained, it takes them another 1 or 2 years before they start coming up with their own ideas. And, Bristol, I think this could be a good route because I did this looks promising. And then it becomes even more interesting because as a PhD student, ultimately, you should be a researcher that can work independently.
Right. So when you're looking at potential PhD students, what qualities do you look for in a student that makes you think, oh, I really want to work with him or her?
Right. So by now, undergraduates have had often an opportunity to already do some experimental work. And so and we have this wonderful new vertically integrated project at Burke Nanotechnology Center that allows now for the first time, thanks to sponsors paying for these students to be educated, to learn how to use the equipment. So these students, of course, for me, are prime because they already have the training to some extent through this vertically integrated project. And I'm part of this effort, and I'm watching very carefully how they kind of develop. Besides that, of course, I'm also interviewing students from across the globe and trying to find out, do they bring something to the table, ideally, that shows, yes, they have done a little bit of experiment here or there already. And when they are describing what they have done, and not only have they done it, but they can also give me the background and they show their understanding, then this is potential candidate.
So one of the big things for, I'm sure, engineering students is failure. And you probably fail as much as you succeed. How do you teach your students that failure isn't the end, that it's just sending you on a new path?
Right. Yes, failure is part of the journey. Should not be the only part of what you're experiencing. So when I'm getting funded by industry, they want to know all the things that didn't work. So they explicitly, in these meetings, encourage the students to report what didn't work out. And the student realized this is value because I mentioned to you that there are these pathfinding groups in industry. And they want to know what not to try because it has already failed.
Right?
So this is part of it. And many students struggle first with that. They want to not reveal what didn't work out. But I think many of them learn what's going on. But then the truth of the matter is you have over these years of PhD work, you have to have some success.
Yes.
This is not what you predicted you would be successful in. It's something that you discovered. For example, the student that discovered this memory application, she was supposed to work on two-dimensional materials. She discovered that the Thin Conductor Research Corporation, SRC, that was funding this research, said, wow, this is great. we are filing a patent about this. So there is also flexibility from the sponsor side to acknowledge that research is not like your development, where this step, it's unpredictable, often, also to the good direction.
Right. So if you're talking to an undergrad today who's kind of trying to decide their path, what would you tell them about why this field in particular is important to pay attention to?
Right. So the semiconductor industry is desperately looking for a workforce. So it's interesting to note that some of our sponsors, I'm not going to mention, come to this VIP class where we have only undergraduates. And they're saying, send them all over, we hire them all. And I think that's a message that undergraduates understand.
Yeah.
That you are having skills that are extremely valuable. Why is this something special here in this case? Well, this hands-on training, we were unable to do that in the Burbank Technology Center until Professor Chen actually decided to make this little experiment. We started out with 5 students. We didn't know how to fund this.
Right.
We got some support from ECE to do this initially, and it was a great success. The students loved it. The industry loved that. We sent them to internship and said, whoa, they know already all the things that we would have to train them for the first year. So this is great. The program by now is capped at 50 students per semester. It's just, we can't handle more in the Burbank Center. And all the seats are occupied. We have more than 100 something applicants. We have to down select, unfortunately. And they all play jobs.
That's amazing.
It's a very different animal. So that's what we are telling the students. You don't worry a thing. If you're doing well here, that's good.
You're set up for a future. Do you want to talk a little bit about your center for secure microelectronics?
Ecosystem.
Ecosystem. Okay. I didn't know what that last one was.
Yeah. So that's interesting. We started about 6 years ago or so, a conversation about what could Purdue do in order to help our United States to develop chips that are secure, that can be used even for military applications, DoD applications, without being tampered with. So imagine, right, these chips get built somewhere abroad. They get shuttled around. There are many, many process steps all over the world. You see what's called the supply chain before these chips are coming back. I mean, so many different entities have touched
these chips.
And back then, there was the request from our government to say, can you somehow ensure that although we don't trust, it's called the zero trust environment, although we don't trust all the entities involved, we want to make sure that we can trust the end product. Help us to reach that state. And so this was the basis for funding this consortium. Industry is interested in being trustworthy as well. So this is where we did something that didn't previously exist exactly in this way. We married academia, government, and industry together in a consortium back-to-back with this workforce development, this asymmetric workforce development scale that my colleague Professor Peter Wimmel is handling. And we are taking on the scale graduate trainees that are only U.S. citizens working together in the consortium with international students as well, and all focusing on what I described before. So that's, in a nutshell, what we are doing there in the Center for Secure Microelectronic Ecosystem.
You mentioned how Purdue is a good place to do the 2D research and a good place to be. Can you expand on that a little, including just what's the importance of interdisciplinary work?
So my team has people from mechanical engineering, material science, and engineering in it. That is what I call it, interdisciplinary, because there are materials-related questions that we need to address. There are engineering-related questions. There are physics-related questions. There are thermal-related issues. I mean, these elements can become very hot. How do you dissipate energy? How do you prevent them to destroy themselves, right? So there are many of these aspects, and that is why interdisciplinarity is really, really important. It turns out that a couple of faculty were separately working on various 2D aspects. I knew only of a couple of them. And when this opportunity came up to assemble a larger team, I reached out to them and we came together. We are working on this now together with, I think, 12 students or so on, and the IMEC team. And we identified that we have a little overlap, but at the same time, we have the same common 2D in mind that we need to kind of work on. And so it was naturally divide and conquer that we took on different tasks that are all related to this 2D. Now,
2D, as I said, for me, was a natural extension of everything I was doing in my past, right?
Yeah.
It really is one of those parts that I stayed with what we call low-dimensional systems my entire career. That is what fascinated me. And yes, I changed the material, and yes, I changed the way I did out of them, but that's a common ground. 1D, 2D, low-dimensional materials, not crystal materials that I'm dealing with.
Why did you change from industry to academia, and how do you help your students decide which path to go?
Yep. Started in academia, then industry, then back into academia. I do like to educate students. I like to make them grow. I consider them my family. I tell them that I'm spending often more time with them than I'm spending with my own kids.
Yes.
And so it's a very close relationship. And when you see them growing and succeeding, and I'm proud to say every single of my PhD students immediately found a job, multiple job offers, and they are out there building my network. And I'm having very close contact with them, right? I like to follow with those that want to. Not everybody is interested in this. But this is ultimately extremely rewarding to see. Now, in industry, it was fascinating to work with my colleagues with my, that were at IBM, extremely bright and capable. You realized, I shouldn't say realized, at the time when I left, there was a little bit of a sense, and a couple of my colleagues felt the same way, that we didn't quite see where we could continue contributing to evolving this device-related science. It was a dip, I would say. But this dip made me think maybe it's a good opportunity to kind of explore other avenues as well. So the combination of being excited to teach and educate and at the same time seeing new opportunities outside industry with a little bit more flexibility to explore things that I was curious about, that was ultimately for me the driver to do this. Now, when I'm talking to my students, most of them want to work in industry. Naturally, it's a very small crowd that has this curiosity and says, I want to stay in the academia. Path is very hard. It became increasingly hard now for young faculty to do it. It's a very tough decision to make. And of course, before you get tenured, there's enormous pressure on people to do that. So I'm trying to work with a student. I meet every of my students a couple of times per week. And I try to coach them in an individual fashion. I'm honest with them. I think you are really good at this.
Right.
I'm not going to tell them that they're not good at it. I'm telling them this is what they're good at. I would recommend you kind of further look into this direction, improve yourself, right? That's one thing that's extremely important that I'm trying to do with the undergraduates that want to make a decision. And I'm telling each and everybody, my door is open. Send me an email that I can make sure that I put you on my calendar. And then I'm happy to talk about whatever you want to talk about.
So you mentioned that you spend more time with your students than with your family. But when you do happen to have free time, what do you like to do to relax or just, you know, get out of the lab?
Yeah, so I'm the gardener. So I'm spending my time in my yard, and I'm responsible for planting and flowers and fertilizing and taking care of everything there. And I like to do that very much because there's immediate reward.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of those things in my job, right? Sometimes I'm working on a project and a proposal for a long, long time, and I don't see the outcome.
Right.
Sometimes the outcome is also negative, which I recommend. So working in the yard is this immediate positive feedback that I really enjoy a lot. Being outdoors compensates for being inside all the time at the office desk, right? And having to stare at the computer. So I really enjoy that a lot.
And you can tell your son, this is what I accomplished, that this
is that's right.
So are your sons engineers?
No, not at all. So both of them went through Purdue. Both of them studied here. Both of them are back in town. And both of them got married this year.
Oh, wow.
So I'm very lucky to have them around. So one of them is a computer scientist. He came back because he can work more remotely.
Yeah.
And the other one is in hospitality and then. So it's really not the same as for me.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about 2D material.
Thanks for having me.
That's all for this episode of Engineering Innovations. If you enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss future episodes. If you liked, which also leave us a review, that helps more people the show. Even better, you can share this episode with a friend or colleague who might be interested. about where engineering is headed. Don't forget to follow Purdue ECE on social media. You can find links to our social media show notes. I'm Kristen Malavenda. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time as we learn more about how Purdue ECE engineers are shaping